McElligot's Pool is one of Dr. Seuss's earliest children's books. It was written in 1947, years before The Cat in the Hat made the likes of Dick, Jane, and Spot. Hold up your hands if you remember Dick, Jane, and Spot. Ah, yes, my easy reader books. Before The Cat in the Hat made Dick, Jane, and Spot run, run, run for their lives, before a book that was filled not only with simple words, but with real imaginative power. Not just fun that rhymes with run, but with joy and hope and giddy gladness. I'll say much more about Seuss and children's books later. But first, I need to ask you to use your own imaginative power to consider a question that may seem to have nothing to do with children's concerns. I'm thinking about that body of water a moment ago, right? Have you ever thought about where you want your ashes scattered? Or if you want any ashes, or any scattering when your time comes? I'm not trying to startle you, but it's something worth thinking about. It's also good to let a few other people know what you want done with your mortal remains, ashes, or otherwise. I don't know what most of you think about death or whatever might follow. You may believe that a bit of dry or wet material is all that will be left of you after dying. But you might like to know where at least that much of you will go. There's a widespread preference among people who attend religious communities like this one for cremation rather than burial. There's no doctrine behind this, nor any widespread understanding about what it means to go to a grave or elsewhere when you go. People who choose to become ashes also usually choose to have those ashes scattered over a body of water. A big moving one like the ocean or a river, maybe? What's this about? Enough real estate already, we seem to be saying. Buying and maintaining it. I don't need that expensive plot. I'm sure that this doesn't express a wish to be nowhere after dying, but more a feeling that scattering ashes is a glad and truthful thing to do. Somehow, instead of being gone from the world, will be everywhere and anywhere. Widespread. Spread wide. I used to be pretty clear about where my ashes should go. There was a shallow depression in the forest preserve near my childhood home in Illinois. During wet years, this depression would fill with water, getting maybe 2 or 3 feet at the deepest, or more if you counted the layer of muck at the bottom. Neighborhood children called it the frog pond. Some years it could be dry for months on end, but when it was full, the frog pond drew kids like a magnet, especially this kid. I'd squat for hours at the water margin and submerge my thoughts in the reflected tree and sky and whatever lay below. It's not much of a body of water in comparison to the Columbia or the Willamette, much less the Pacific Ocean. A strange place, you might think, for someone to wish for their ashes to be scattered. The water was dark and stagnant, half of it runoff from the polluted Salt Creek nearby, which then was our town's open sewer. But it was the nearest body of water to my home. The nearest one. And that is always precious to a child. Just as McElligot's Pool was to Marco. Calling it the frog pond was a local kid's tradition, but I don't remember anyone ever catching any frogs there, or turtles, or anything you'd want for show and tell. At the Salt Creek, you could still catch an occasional snapping turtle or some carp in spite of the heavy pollution, but the frog pond? Why was I so drawn to a body of water that offered so little? Why have my ashes scattered there when I die, of all places? When I was just learning to read, someone gave me a little book, The Golden Guide to Seashores. Anybody remember The Golden Guides? They're still made, I think. He was a perfect companion to Mogilevich's pool, filled with pictures of creatures that you find on Atlantic beaches or Pacific tide pools. Just the sort of thing a kid could expect to do regularly in Illinois. But no matter, I pored over it, memorizing the beautiful ink drawings and names of sand dollars, sun stars, sea anemones, sea cucumbers, spiny sea urchins. You've seen them. But I wanted to see them for real, and to touch them, and to know them. So such a desire had to find a way out, a way to reach from me to others. So I came out of the woods one day, and I told the other kids that I'd been to the frog pond, and I had seen a holy host of creatures that I proceeded to describe. Sun stars, sea anemones, spiny urchins, and so on. I don't remember exactly. Did I say that they were there in the pond, or that I could look through the pond and see all the way to the oceans where they really are found? I don't remember for sure. I was still very young. And I saw them. I saw them. You want to see them too, guys? I certainly saw them in my imagination, which little children have an ocean of, not just a pond. But I still wince a little bit when I remember telling my friends, not that I imagined, but that I saw what I was describing. Now, maybe this is an early memory of telling a lie. I've always felt terrible for telling a lie, and I still remember most that I've told. But this didn't feel anything like a lie. I remember being so happy when I first told the kids. I looked for them, came down with me to look. None of them saw like I did. They didn't see anything, but neither did they say anything mean about it. Not that. No one called me a fool. Not even a sort of one. Like the farmer did to Marco as he fished in Mogilevich's pool. If we look at that farmer's face on the first page, he's completely self-assured. He knows about the junk in the pool, the old shoes and the cans. Maybe he's thrown a bit of it in himself. And he feels sort of responsible that the kid hasn't had a bite. But the point he's clear on is that this water offers pretty much nothing. It's small, and it's spoiled. And anyone who would sit there and try to get a line on some sort of life within it must be some sort of fool. Now, the farmer wouldn't have used the word fool if Marco had asked him for information or an opinion. We're generally very happy to share those. Almost no one would speak such a strong word to a child just for asking a question. He has said, no fish in there, not a chance. But the farmer uses such a strong word because Marco, simply sat down and started fishing and stayed for hours. That got him. That rubs him the wrong way. The boy has come with his pole, his line, his hooks, his worms, and his patience. 3 hours already without a bite. But now that Marco is challenged, he reveals that it's something more than patience that brought him to the pool and that keeps him there. Marco agrees with the farmer that there might be no fish. Might be. But there also might be more to the pool than just the pool. It might be connected to an underground river, than the ocean, than the whole world round, even to the rivers flowing down from the mountains of Tibet. All oceans, all fishes might be touched by reaching his line through the pool and beyond. Marco begins with this slender idea of connection, then goes into a hymn, singing with joy about the might of possibility. But again, there's more. This book would have no power if it were just an exercise in wishful thinking. The junk and the shoes and the spoilage of generations are the immediate facts of Mogilevich's pool, just like the spoilage of the Salt Creek mixed with just a bit of fresh rain were the immediate facts of the frog pond near my home, the one with no frogs except in name. Dr. Seuss was no fool in the way the farmer used the term. Theodore Seuss Geisel knew his world and the spoilage worked by power. During World War II, he produced propaganda cartoons to serve the Allied cause. His portraits of Hitler can still make us laugh, while his exaggerations of the features of Japanese leaders might well make us cringe. He went just as fiercely after certain captains of U.S. industry who sought to profit from both sides of the conflict. He lampooned isolationists who tried to ignore what was going on overseas, pretending that the oceans separated our country from most others, separated without connecting it as well. For those who want to see this side of him, I recommend Dr. Seuss Goes to War. It's really wonderful. Again, be prepared to cringe a little bit. These are his collected political cartoons. And I recommend them as wholeheartedly as I recommend Nadjelovitz Pool and all of his children's books. I feel like he's an old friend, like I think many of you do. I also feel like he's a colleague, engaged in much the same kind of work that I do. There's a preacher in Seuss, and a preacher's voice in Marco, who the farmer has told us is sort of a fool. Preacher, sort of a fool. Children's books aren't dissertations, any more than sermons are. They're intended less to inform than to lead their readers and listeners. Lead where? To joy and wonder. Children's books are meant to be read over and over again. And sermons, I must admit, also have a way of saying the same things over and over and speaking to the same ends. Preachers, professional or not, of any denomination or no denomination at all, are obliged to bear glad tidings. We can't share a dark vision that goes nowhere without also pointing to a window, or a door, or a light at the end of a tunnel. It's a different discipline than writing poetry and novels. That light at the end of the tunnel, it has to be there for us, as vividly as the fish are there for Marco, because we know that it might be. It might be that all religious good news is essentially the same. All glad tidings just waves from the same glad tide coming in. Which brings us back to the water's edge. The last page of McGilligan's Pool is almost a repeat of the first. What's changed is the look on the characters' faces. After listening to Marco's sermon on possibility and connection and the wonders of the many, many kinds of fishes, the farmer no longer looks so sure of himself. Marco looks confident and happy. I don't think the farmer has been convinced by Marco's words, but we can see that he's wondered. He's been moved. He may still be sure that he's the one who's right, but Marco's words ring truthful. It's not only what Marco tells him, but the joy in how he tells it. What has moved the farmer is not just the news of hope and possibility, but the gladness of the tidings themselves. Marco says, and he says with joy, this water we see goes all the way to the ocean, the oceans, the world all round. It's the way to all waters. This pool is no container. It's not just a place, but the way to all waters. This pool which is before us, this small pool at our feet, this goes all the way there, there and beyond, and all filled with life. Oh, joy to say and hear and wonder. No body of water, no breath of air is truly isolated, not in its spoilage, nor in the sweet possibility that a foolish eye can't help but see. He sits there, Marco does, between the truth and the gladness of the tidings. and he sends them out together. I've called it a sermon, and I've called it a hymn by Marco, a hymn to all the waters of the world. The sermon and hymn both do the same work by mixing breath and voice and words in their own foolish ways, by mixing the truth and the gladness of the tidings. The truth and the gladness of the tidings. These are not the same, nor are they always equal in a preacher's work. They have a dynamic, living relationship. Sometimes the gladness stretches the truth, and sometimes truth cuts. You know that. And yes, truth can cut. Can cut to make the gladness branch out like pruning does to bushes or damming does to a little stream, making new streams branch out from it. Truth and gladness push and pull, chase and play with each other as they grow together. I've already told you that in all my hours and days of patient waiting, I never caught a frog in that pond in Illinois where I once shared glad tidings with my friends. But then one morning, a few years later, after a night of heavy rain, I went to the frog pond and found its surface covered with fish. Covered with them. They were very small and brown, with pale bellies and pouting humanoid mouths, like the Dr. Seuss fish that go glurk. I probably wouldn't have seen them at all in the brown water if they hadn't been floating, belly up, dead. I was amazed and excited, but I don't remember wanting to go tell the good news to everybody that the frog pond now had fish, but they were all dead. Just more sick overflow from our filthy local creek. 10 more years passed, and I visited the pond again to collect a specimen of muck from its bottom for a college biology class. Under the microscope, I saw creatures that rival anything you could find in the Golden Gyde seashores, or even in the Gilligan's Pool. Let's get the dye in there, especially. Rival anything in the diversity of their forms and their ways of moving. Then, as the contents of the jar settled, I discovered a profusion of some sort of clam or mussel, little bivalves, that climbed the sides of the jar, more like snails, I thought, than clams in the way that they moved. I then designed a very poor experiment to discover how they did. It involved what was supposed to be a gentle heating of a test tube containing a sample clam. Soon there came a terrible pop, sort of a glurk, and out came a flying clam, like Dr. Seuss might draw. Don't ask. I refuse to say anything more about it. Don't you tell me. Except, I will say that I didn't get a very good grade, and I didn't want to think much again about the pond for a very long time. At the beginning of the story, the farmer told Marco that the Gilligan's Pool could only lead to disappointment. Maybe my ashes should only go into the frog pond if I find at the end of my story that I failed in this experiment that's my life. I blew it, literally, with those lively little clams. I never learned how they move, but I learned something else while mapping their origin for my bio lab write-up. The frog pond, it turns out, receives overflow from the Salt Creek, yeah. The Salt Creek joins the Des Plaines River. The Des Plaines runs to the Illinois River. Then the Illinois joins the Mississippi. The Mississippi runs south to the Caribbean and on to the one great ocean that we divide by names, Atlantic, Indian, Pacific. The Pacific is just downstream from here. So the waters of the Frog Pond are connected to the snowmelt flowing down from above us, to the rivers running right nearby, kind of holding this part of town in their arms, to the tide pools of the Pacific just downstream, and to those life forms that I could see as a child. They're not sort of connected, but gladly, truly so. Do I need any more than this to hold my meager ashes? Maybe that's still where it should go. Twice each month in the coming years, if you'd like, I'll come before you and stand here, right here, between the truth and the gladness of the tidings, and do my best to sing those out together. For now, I'll leave you with the glad tidings that the waters which surround your homes reach all the way to a humble little pond not far from Chicago and back again, here. I hope these tidings are as glad for you as they are for me, and I hope that the next ones I share will be just as glad. That's my foolishness for today. Thanks for keeping such an inviting place to share it. It's not just the goofy interview question that your search team sent me. What's your favorite hymn? They actually wrote this. What's your favorite hymn, and can you please sing us some of it? Something about your faces tells me that you all have a pond full of foolishness to share, and more, the kind of foolishness that the world needs so badly today and every day. Foolishness about things like the inherent worth and dignity of every human being, and the interconnectedness of the web of existence of which we are all a part. What would the farmer say to that? Please keep that foolishness with you. Keep bringing it to share when you come, and take some home each time. Never think that your own pond is too small, too contaminated, or too isolated for it to matter, even if it sometimes seems dry or stagnant. Come, speak your good news, and sing it out with gladness. Even when the pool has no fish, and the pond has no frogs, let the tidings we sing still be glad. So many.